It's known as the business end of the environmental movement, with a staff of lawyers and MBAs more prone to power ties than corduroy and desert boots. It's known as the Nature Conservancy, and it often buys what it wants to protect. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. My guests on this edition of Conversations, a man who has served the Nature Conservancy for well over 20 years, Richard Weinstein, and Susan Ruddy, the director of the Alaska chapter of the Nature Conservancy. The Conservancy opened its doors in 1951. Dick, what prompted a business approach to looking at environmentalism?
I'm not sure it started with a business approach, Susan. Actually, a group of ecologists, scientists concerned about the rapid loss of natural areas, got together and began to wonder about how they could start to preserve specimen areas of great importance. And it started with a 60-acre tract in New York State, and it went from there. But I don't think the business orientation really came in a serious way until later, when people like Alexander Adams, who was a vice president of the Chase Manhattan Bank and a nature writer of some consequence, and individuals of that kind came in and realized that the way to do this was to apply business principles to the preservation of natural diversity.
When you said to preserve specimen, do you mean that they particularly were looking at a type of plant or a type of animal they felt was endangered? Very specific?
Individually, I don't think that they went for a particular plant or a particular animal, but I think what they were trying to do was to acquire habitat which was occupied by species that were becoming endangered, mm-hmm. as they understood them. Beautiful areas as well, but as the focus began to develop, they used their science skills, and ultimately they began about 20 years ago, as the organization grew, to develop a database of information about species and the habitats that they occupied, where they were located, and the levels of threat under which they existed.
Was this also fairly unique to take a scientific approach?
Well, I'm sure there are other organizations that use science in their work, but I think clearly it was the first time that anybody ever said, let's put together a database. It started in South Carolina, I think, almost 20 years ago, first to go in there and start to assemble the information and start to computerize the data and to establish something that was then called a heritage program, a state heritage program. And over the next 20 years, there are 50 state heritage programs, the last of which was developed here in Alaska and actually is going into your state university almost as we speak.
Which takes us to Susan Ruddy. 1988, the Alaska Nature Conservancy was established. Was this in the course of things? It was time for the 49th state to be included, or was there something that prompted the establishment of a chapter in Alaska?
I think it had more to do with the fact that the conservancy programs in general had just reached enough maturity so that they could branch out. It had been the Washington-Alaska program for many years, and they found they couldn't do effective conservation from the Washington office in Seattle. So they decided to open an Alaska office in 88.
Do you think this is also the reason for on-site chapters, is you have to be on-site?
Yes, definitely. Huh. And you can imagine here in Alaska how Alaskans would react to having somebody come up from Seattle and tell them how to conduct their conservation. Well, we see that all the time when people come in from outside the state with outside organizations and suggest how we should do our business. We ran into that too, and that's when the Conservancy decided to open an office here.
Does that also mean to the two of you, with each of your different experiences, that a local conservancy is a local conservancy advised by the national? But
I think it's almost a decentralized organization with local leadership. For example, we have in each of our 50 state chapters boards of trustees, many of whom are extremely significant individuals within their own state. As a matter of fact, there is probably no state program that doesn't have leading individuals in those states, usually diversified within the state geographically, which help to establish the priorities and define the movement of that state program. Conservation is done in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And each state is a backyard. But then above that, there's a structure that gives the kinds of things that general headquarters give set the direction of the organization overall, et cetera, and so on.
We rely very much here in Alaska on the national program. We have a small staff of only 6 people, and we couldn't possibly accomplish what we have if we hadn't had the national staff to turn to. None of us had ever been with a conservancy before, so we didn't have that kind of experience. And being able to draw on the national staff has made all the difference in the world. We probably have at least one national staff person here every month.
Oh,
and have
perfect.
Had since the beginning, yeah.
Let me reintroduce, if people have tuned in later than the top of the hour. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. We're talking today with two representatives of the Nature Conservancy. A little bit more about the Nature Conservancy in a moment. Dick Weinstein's been with the Nature Conservancy since 1970. He serves the Conservancy's National Board of Governors. He is currently a trustee and a former chair of the Florida chapter of the Nature Conservancy as well. And he is the immediate past chair of the Nature Conservancy's International Governing Council. That has been his position for how long?
It was 2 1-year terms.
2 1-year terms.
That's all you're allowed is. I finished last year, and so I'm completing now my service on the National Board of Governors.
Richard Weinstein is an attorney. He was also for 12 years chairman of the board of a Connecticut bank. So this is a gentleman who comes from a background in law and in banking. Susan Ruddy is our other guest. She's from the Alaska chapter of the Nature Conservancy. It was established in 1988, and she is the founding director, having been with the organization now 5.5 years. Her background is in mediation and in mediating environmental disputes. You're listening to Conversation on KUAC. You mentioned a heritage project. Tell me what that is, Dick. And then, Susan, maybe you can tell me what it is in Alaska.
That is the science-based program developed by the Nature Conservancy, now in all 50 of the United States, where data is assembled in that state from varying sources, from universities, from scientists, from systematics, people who keep collections of one kind or another, to try to establish the location of the rare and endangered species within that state. We're talking across the board, animals, fish, plants, and so forth. That data is put into a database, which has been over time developed and is uniformly in all of the states. All of these interconnect. And that data is used to help make development decisions and decide where things should be built or not built, as the case may be, kind of an early warning about how many or how few of a particular species may exist, and help us in our quest to preserve biodiversity, the diversity of all of these creatures, which we think is important. And what we've learned is that the way to preserve biodiversity is to protect the habitat of the species.
An odd question. If one of your missions is to create as complete a database as possible, and if my assumption is right that that's a slow process,
mm-hmm.
Aren't you a frustrating organization for development developers or for government agencies or...
Yes, I think it is a frustrating process sometimes. We have rapid ecological assessment available as well. They have the GIS systems, which Susan can probably develop more discussion on. But the point is, we try to fit our method of collecting data and presenting data to whatever the situation requires. The one thing we do is to maintain the standard, the scientific standards across the board.
And you know, actually, Susan, in response to that question also, once the database is up, it provides, in effect, one-stop shopping. So that an agency or all the agencies involved in permitting a project of one sort or another, as well as the industry involved in the project and the conservation community, can come to this one source and get all the information they need in order to answer their questions. They don't have to go to 20 different agencies to get the data. It's all in one place.
And do they come
yes,
to the
they
one
do.
Source?
They do. Our program is young, so our database isn't very mature yet. We've been working on it for about 4 years, and it's pretty remarkable what's been accomplished in that period of time. We've had good financial support for it. So it's really coming along, and we're used now by all of those groups.
Tell me what you did after the Exxon Valdez. I understand you stepped in and offered to catalog the problems and damage created by the accident. Is that so?
No, not exactly. They came to us and asked us if we would prepare for them a manual, basically, on strategies that the Conservancy has used in the South 48 and in Latin America to identify ecologically critical areas and then to protect them. And we did do that.
In the Prince William Sound?
In the oil spill affected area, which runs from Cordova all the way down through the Kodiak Archipelago.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't actually at that time go out on the landscape and do any of the identifying. We just gave them the strategies that we have used. It's basically like a textbook. And it's something I wished at the time we had had when I first started with the Conservancy. It's a terrific Nature Conservancy 101 document.
Because it tells you what? Can you give me a picture of if I open the book in search of, what am I going to find? What's there for me?
The first thing you'll find is half the book is dedicated to how to find these critical areas, how to identify them, and all the different kind of strategies that are available to you. Dick mentioned GIS.
An acronym which means?
Which means Geographic Information Systems. It's a computer-based mapping system that we have in lots of places in Alaska. We aren't actually using it, but we have data that we have contributed to it, and we've gotten data from it. There is something called gap analysis, where they go out and look at different areas that have already been identified on the landscape as being critical. The information comes from a variety of sources, and then they try to figure out where information is not adequate to make good policy decisions. So they analyze the gaps in between the existing databases. In an example in Alaska, we haven't done this yet, but an example would be up on the North Slope. We have a great deal of data. That's an area that's been very, very intensely studied for a long time. So we have good data there. Now, it might be that just south of the Prudhoe Bay area or south of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, we might not have as much data. We would identify those kind of data gaps in this gap analysis. There is also satellite imagery. There are just a whole variety of strategies you can use.
This is transforming the face of environmentalism, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's doing it in a fairly methodical way. Whether it's transforming it remains to be seen, because despite our progress over time, and we have progressed in the lower 48, we've acquired over 7 million acres of critically important land, and elsewhere we've assisted in Central and South America in many transactions of great size. It's still almost a drop in the bucket when you compare it to the landmass. You come up here to Alaska and you've got something like 500,000 square miles of absolutely magnificent property, and you scratch your head and you wonder, how will you ever? And the answer is probably not through an individual or even a collection of organizations, but rather through the mass conclusions of all the people that's going to have to be done as a way of thinking and a way of living.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned acquisitions. We talked a bit about the money and legal arm of the Nature Conservancy at the beginning, but then left it for science. Talk to me about acquisitions. Why did the Nature Conservancy determine it was important to buy land it felt was endangered?
Well, I think it's quite obvious that if you want to make sure that something is going to be protected, you own it. And so that was our original approach to it, that you buy it and you put it, you tuck it away, and you then manage it in a correct, environmentally careful way. Over time, we began to realize there had to be other tools, because you just cannot raise enough money through nonprofit activity to buy what you need, nor can you encourage enough people to buy everything. So you find that there are other levels of protection, such as easements, for example, and agreements of varying kinds that will allow you to protect land without purchasing it. And gradually, over time, we have come to realize that acquiring and protecting relatively small areas of land is not sufficient, that what you've got to do is you've got to look at the big picture, as they say, And that's what we're trying to do now, and most recently in a campaign that we call illustratively The Last Great Places, where we've tried to identify important areas, ecosystems, many of them of for example, the Florida Keys as an ecosystem. Well, clearly we're not going to buy it and put it away. What we're going to do is to try and figure out how to preserve, protect, and defend the Keys, and at the same time allow some sufficient balance so that there can be human activity of the kind that won't damage or destroy the resource but will allow mankind to exist side by side with nature.
Get specific. What are some of the things that you're doing in the Keys?
Well, in the Keys we are doing a number of things. One of the things we're doing is we're studying the reef system, which is suffering very badly, which runs, it's a 200-mile reef that runs alongside the Keys, the longest reef in America. And it's starting to suffer badly from all scientific evaluation from something. And we have a scientific team that's been working for a number of years now, and they're trying to assess the reasons for the degradation of the reef system. At the same time, Florida Bay, which is on the other side of the Keys and which comes down below the Everglades, has been having terrible stress and terrible trouble. They're having a lot of algae blooms on it. The fishing has declined in a very grave way, and people are concerned that the Florida Bay, which is a giant bay to the west of the Keys, is going to affect and has already affected the fishing. It sounds familiar if you're in Alaska, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's happening down there as well. We are trying to work in coalition with others to try and figure out the reasons for it and take the kinds of steps that are necessary. Agriculture, sugar, the quality of water going down through the Everglades and ultimately emptying into Florida Bay, these are the matters of concern to us. And so we're working along a large number of fronts. In Florida, we have assisted in the development of a major land acquisition program called Preservation 2000. The Florida legislature and two successive governors have supported the idea of significant public land acquisition in Florida, environmentally sensitive lands. Here in Alaska, you say, my goodness, they can't buy anymore. But in Florida, they didn't buy enough. And the result is Florida is very heavily developed considering the kind of ecosystems, very fragile ecosystems. So they are spending at the level of about $300 million a year in Florida to buy land for the state and the water management districts. And at the same time, other counties have voted. There are 8 counties in Florida that have voted to increase their taxes by votes in one case of 68% of the people for bond issues to buy land in those counties. Palm Beach County, the taxpayers voted to spend $100 million to buy environmentally sensitive lands, and they asked the Nature Conservancy to do the land buying for them because they decided that they wanted private land buyers who have a long track record of being skilled negotiators and fair buyers to do it on behalf of the public, and they're very happy with the results so far because we've saved a fair amount of money for the public.
This is an interesting alliance to me. The environmental movement is it's not thought of necessarily as pure, but one would think of as idealistic, pure-minded, whereas the almighty dollar, which rules our nation, is very seldom thought of as something that is idealistic or clean or pure. People trust land buyers, essentially, the Nature Conservancy, to work on behalf of the environment. I think I'm wondering, how did you build your reputation so that people trust you to do well by the environment and do well by their dollars as well?
I think, how do you build your reputation? Al Smith, who ran once for president of the United States, used to say, let's look at the record. And I think that they look at the record of the Nature Conservancy over 40-odd years. They look at us as conciliators. They look at us as very quiet, mind your own business. Don't lie down in front of bulldozers. Get the job done. Make love, not war. However you want to frame it, Our reputation came event by event, program by program. Susan Ruddy will build a reputation, as she already has here in Alaska, so that when people hear the name, the Nature Conservancy, they'll say, I like them, I want to support them. They do well, whether they like environmental organizations or love them or dislike them. They will view the Nature Conservancy as a very important part of the landscape if they want to save what's here.
Do you think, Susan, a mediative approach is part of the reason for the success?
Oh, definitely. I think of us as spending less time articulating the problems than we do trying to define the solutions. And I think that is a mediative approach, as you put it. We worked, for instance, recently on the settlement of the Kachemak Bay buyback, which I'm sure you've read about. There are 24,000 acres which were scheduled to be logged this summer. And we have worked with the various constituents in that area and with the three landowners, the Native corporations, which own the surface and the subsurface, and the logging company, to reach an agreement that could then be taken to the prospective buyers, who in this case were the Trustees Council and the state legislature and the state government. The money came from three separate pots, and there were three separate sellers. And they really, I think, would all agree that having somebody in the middle to kind of play traffic cop, mm-hmm. you know, it's almost like arriving on the scene of an accident and just standing there and directing traffic. It really helps to have somebody in the middle doing that kind of thing. And the Conservancy often plays that role.
Do you, in that role, and I'll ask this of both of you if you like, advocate for the place of the tree in the ecological system as much as you are advocating for the forest as a park or the forest as an area of use? Am I making myself clear?
I'm not sure that I understand your question exactly. What we think of the environment as our constituent, in effect. We don't necessarily advocate for a specific species as much as we do for the health of the whole system, because without the systemic health, you don't have the individual species health.
But it is the environment as constituent that is your...
Yeah, in a way. Reason. In a way, for example, you go into a bond issue, and if you're asked how you feel about it, you're really saying the environment's the candidate, and the people are voting yes for that candidate or no for that candidate. And they, you know, the people are not voting to increase their taxes casually. They're voting because they want to see the environment preserved, because they know that they're transitory trustees and that there are many generations yet to come, and the one unforgivable thing will be if, in the course of our stewardship, we don't do the best that we can.
Do you think attitudes are changing in this nation at
Absolutely.
This time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They are.
Evidence, why?
Well, evidence is, what are we doing here? We're spending an hour of your important time talking about the environment. You couldn't get 6 minutes a long time ago. And I can tell you, having come out of a much more confrontational background, I'm a trial lawyer, and my early introduction to the Nature Conservancy was when I opposed, as part of a group and as a volunteer, which is what I am, a nuclear power plant in a very bad place which was never built. I can tell you that it was at that time and through that experience that I learned that there are better ways to resolve these issues. And I think the Nature Conservancy discovered one of those ways. And I think Susan has spoken very clearly about how this kind of thing works, whether you do it in Alaska or whether you do it anywhere else.
You know, one of the things I have felt for a long time, I've been a member of the Nature Conservancy for a long time, long before I joined the staff. And when I was mediating environmental disputes here, I often found that we needed data that we had a hard time getting. We could get biological data, for instance, from the Fish and Game Department, or we could get it from DNR. If we got it from one or the other, somebody was always suspicious of it. If we got it from Fish and Game, then the development interests were suspicious. If we got it from DNR, then the conservation interests were suspicious. I really, at that time, began to think about how wonderful it would be to have an organization like the Conservancy here with the Heritage Database, which is really highly respected for its objectivity. It's not seen as being aligned. And that's one of the reasons why we don't take positions on issues. We are anxious to continue that respect for our objectivity. I felt as an Alaskan, which I am first and foremost, I've been here for almost 30 years, so Alaska is very, very important to me. And I felt as an Alaskan, the Conservancy would be a wonderful organization to have here because it does sit in the middle of the road. We do try to bring interests from both sides to the resolution of whatever the problem is we're facing, mm-hmm. rather than aligning with one side or the other.
Susan Ruddy is with us 5.5 years, the director of the Alaska Nature Conservancy, the duration of its existence here in Alaska. She attended school at Vassar, graduated in 1963, and came to Alaska, as she says, the following year. In her past, she has mediated environmental disputes for the Mediation Institute, an organization based in Seattle. Susan Ruddy, our guest, one of our two guests here on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Dick Weinstein is also with us. Susan, you were talking about people who distrusted agencies that distrusted other agencies. I want to raise a couple of criticisms of the Nature Conservancy that I've read in my research for this interview and ask you to think them through for me from your perspective. What I assume to be quite a conservative magazine called the National Review West criticized the Nature Conservancy on three different counts, one of which was for kind of colluding with the government in the major buying of huge tracts of land that removed them from the tax rolls, removed them from the hands of the individual, and locked them up, tied them up in government hands. The criticism, I think, here is that government will not do a good job as a steward of the land, whereas the individual will do a good job as the steward of the land.
Well, we have indeed acted as an agent for various governmental agencies when they have needed somebody to acquire land prior to the time that they were funded that we deemed to be environmentally sensitive and important to protect. We've been out ahead of the government at their request and because it was in the interest of our own mission. I have no problem with that. As a matter of fact, there are many instances where property that should have been saved was saved. But to say that we do this as an agent of government, we do it as an agent of our mission. A good illustration of the way we mostly work is what recently happened with a property called the Gray Ranch. There was a
huge tract in New Mexico.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Southwestern New Mexico, 500 square miles, most unbelievable property, except until I got to Alaska, that I'd seen. And
you're required to say that, state to state.
I know, right? I say it because it's true. I mean, I just got back from Glacier Bay. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to Denali, so I'm very excited. That ranch, which we bought with our own money, we first of all planned, took a look at it, said how can you preserve it the best possible way and yet use it as a cattle ranch, and then looked for an environmental buyer, and we found one who had a 20-odd year record of running a nearby ranch in a very environmentally sensitive way. Foundation was established, and that ranch is being transferred to a new foundation called the Animas Foundation. We are leaving literally millions of dollars of our contributors' money, and mine included, because I not only volunteer, but I give, and so does Susan, I'm sure. We're leaving a lot of our money there to make sure that the property is protected by that foundation. We have put all kinds of legal restrictions on the future use of that property, so they'll have cattle on it, and the ranch will remain pristine, and it's got an incredible number of mammals, more mammals, in fact, supposedly, than Yellowstone Park. So that's a private enterprise operation, top to bottom. Those who say that we work for the government ought to take a look at the Gray Ranch. Mm-hmm. One other illustration. We've privately raised and saved the Barnard Ranch outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and have acquired some additional properties as well, which is the last tall grass prairie preserved in the United States. That's a private fundraising thing, and I can tell you that in October they're going to reintroduce bison on the 35 or 40,000 acres out there, and I'm going out to watch it happen.
When you preserve land, people would say to you, "Preserve for what? You're closing the gates on it."
No. None of our preserves are closed unless the preserve is so sensitive that injury can happen to the resource that we're trying to protect or the species whose home we're trying to protect. I can illustrate it by saying that there's a cactus that we have acquired an area for the last stand of a cactus called the semaphore down in the Keys. We don't tell anybody except certain scientists where it is because there are people who collect cactus and would love to take one home. We don't want them to do that. And for various scientific reasons, it's important to preserve all of these elements if you're able to do that. On the other hand, we have many, many preserves that are wide open for use, you know, within the regulations of any property owner. We're private property owners. We have the largest private preserve system in the world. We have 1,300 preserves, okay? And that's the way we've learned to manage property correctly, and those are the lessons we're trying to share with others, other private owners and other public owners. And what was their next complaint?
Hold on, this one has money in it, so I have to stop and look at the numbers. Okay, here we are. All right. A next concern was profit-making on the part of the Nature Conservancy. In this criticism, again, by a 1992 issue of the National Review West, the author says the Nature Conservancy paid $100 for an option to buy 5,529 acres in Oregon. Bureau of Land Management gave the Nature Conservancy $1.5 million. The Nature Conservancy paid $1.26 million for the property and took home a profit of $140,000. The National Review West says this is profiteering. What does the Nature Conservancy say?
I can tell you what our practice is. I don't know that particular episode, nor do I know the publication that you're quoting. I'm not a subscriber to that particular publication. When we operate for public agencies and go out in the field and acquire something because they want it to be acquired, we operate on an overall principle of trying to recoup our cost in doing this. But we limit ourselves to what we call the 3-2-1. We get 3% of the first 500,000, 2% of the next 500,000, and 1% thereafter for whatever work we may do in acquiring this property. I can tell you in Palm Beach County we've saved $12 million. I'll send you the editorial so far for the public, and they love it. I think, in fact, when we buy land for the government, we have to operate under the statutes that they proceed under. I can tell you that if we profiteered, we'd be out of business, and I haven't read that story, but send me a copy.
I'd be glad to.
And the third... Is that enough?
I don't know.
From?
Oh, no, it was when we talked about earlier about locking up the land, taking it out of the hands of the people.
Yeah, but it really isn't. It's wide open. I mean, we have a wonderful preserve called Blowing Rocks up in Martin County, Florida, where we get 150,000 visitors a year. What can I tell you?
Did you have a comment, Susan?
I did
Reddy?
Have a comment. Going back to what you were saying about... the Conservancy acting as an agent of government and locking up the land. We think of ourselves in many ways as being very much the private property arm of the conservation community. Here in Alaska, for instance, Jay and Bella Hammond, Governor Jay and Bella Hammond, gave us a conservation easement on their homestead out at Lake Clark. And they did that because for a number of reasons. One, you know them well enough to know that what they wanted, in part at least, was to preserve the character of that homestead they've loved all these years. They also knew that when they die, that property will go into their estate. Their children will have to pay significant taxes on that property. By granting a conservation easement that takes away some of the development potential on that land, they do receive some tax benefit. So when they die, their estate taxes won't be as high. Their kids will be able to hang on to the land. They were able to design that conservation easement to meet their particular family's needs. They, for instance, can build, I don't remember the terms of the easement, but they can build one or two more small cabins on the property, and that's it. So it can't be subdivided. Nobody can go in there and put up vacation condos or something like that. Their kids can retain it, and they granted the easement to us. In our discussions with them prior to the time they granted us this easement, we pointed out the fact that it would be difficult for us, with our Anchorage office and a very small staff, to actually manage that land for them adequately. So we suggested that they consider letting us pass the easement along to the National Park Service, who has parklands all around their homestead and can, in fact, manage the easement better than we can. And that was agreeable to the Hammonds. We would not have done that had it not been agreeable to them. In some instances, people want to keep the title to their land. They want to keep the fee interest. They don't want to give the land away, but they want to accomplish a conservation goal. The Hammonds did it that way. We've had some people in the Eagle River Valley near Anchorage recently do something very similar. In this instance, however, they wanted us to retain some covenants within the title or some strings in effect on the easement so that if the government agency which is taking over the easement doesn't manage it the way they wanted it managed, we have some leverage to go back in and work with the agency to have it managed the way the donors wanted it managed. So the fee, the title, stays in the hands of the private landowner, but they are able to accomplish the conservation. And it also accomplishes the public goal, in this instance, of protecting the Eagle River watershed, which is something we're all concerned about.
Let there be no mistake about it. We're in business only because individuals and businesses and foundations support us with their contributions. When they stop, we're out of business. So to the extent that we are a private agency, we are private because the people are keeping us in business with their money mm-hmm. and their gifts.
And your future depends on doing good in the eyes of others as well as in the future of the land.
I think we feel that we are rated by the growth of our organization, the effectiveness of our organization, and we've been moving in the right direction. We're on a good trajectory, and people, we feel, are supportive of the work that we do.
Another peculiar question. Don Young argues for opening the coastal plain that if it is not done in a slow, thoughtfully managed way, at some point, oil-starved Americans will literally break down the laws, break down the gates, and demand that the coastal plain oil be squeezed out like a sponge. That is to say, we should go after as many resources as possible, because someday, if we lock them up, kind of irresponsible instincts will take over.
I don't know enough about the issue to tell you whether that's a sensible approach or not, but I know that there's plenty of conflict every time some business or organization wants to do something. There's somebody that doesn't want them to do it. And I guess my feeling about it is that we have managed to stay around 40 years doing our thing because we have not gotten into every dispute that is out mm-hmm. there.
Okay.
And nor can we, even though many of us may have our own private views on what should or should not occur. I think the point is that we try to stay very focused, as any business ought to do, on our business.
Okay. Tell me about the international interests of the Nature Conservancy. What took you out of the United States, and where'd you go first? Why?
Well, we went south first because that's where the birds go in the wintertime. And as the robins began to disappear in Cleveland, and they began to wonder why, and, you know, obviously it became well known that the enormous diversity of the tropical areas far exceeded our own, we became concerned. So we have been working for a number of years in Central and South America, and we currently have ongoing programs with other nonprofit organizations in something like 30 other countries in Central and South America, and we have established comparable data centers to our own, which we call Conservation Data Centers, CDCs, all connected with each other in many of these countries. There are a couple of differences between the way we function in the United States and the way we function in Latin America, and that is we don't buy any land outside of the United States, period. sure invitation in some places to have your forest chopped down would be to say an American company owns it. And so we work only with governments or nonprofits in those areas. We try to share the expertise that we have developed over 40-odd years. We help to train their people. We introduce them to funding sources that we already know and use. And we actually send people down there to work with them on the ground. What we are doing is we're hoping to develop the same kind of conservation ethic there that we have here. A year or 2 years ago, we for example, get together with Conservation Training Week, where we bring hundreds, some at their own expense, some with our assistance, some with the assistance of other charitable organizations, to a week of training sessions where they exchange information about what's happening in their countries. These are all proud, effective, independent, individual programs. But when they get together, it's the most exciting thing you ever saw. And they're learning from each other, and guess what? We're learning from them at the same time. So it's kind of a win-win. That's the way we function there.
Tell me about the rainforest programs.
Well, we have rainforest programs as we have programs. We tend to focus on the hot spots in all of these countries. We try to, for example, it's well known that in many of the Latin American countries they have paper parks, so-called, parks that have been declared to be protected that are in fact not protected. And we have a program that we call Parks in Peril, which hopes to help them protect their own parks. You see, they own this land, and they must determine to save, protect it. We can't. We can't impose it on them. But we can show them a lot of things, like debt swaps, for example, which will generate some economic sustenance to help them with funding these protection efforts.
Tell me about a debt swap.
A debt swap is where either through a gift or through some use of other public funding, you are able to get the debt of a country that's out in the marketplace. Let me illustrate it. The country of Panama, for example, has public debt outstanding, where it borrowed money, and those obligations are in the hand of private banks and people like that. We will go to them and try to buy those obligations or have them given to us. We will then put them with a conservation organization in Panama, and the government will issue bonds in exchange for them, conservation bonds. The income from those bonds will be used for the protection of natural areas in that country.
So the protection of a natural area is not a liability in that case?
No, it helps the country. It helps the country. It gets some of their debt off the books, and it accomplishes a mission that all mankind should want, which is to see the whole world treated a little more gently, because we are very interdependent, as you know.
When you go to Panama or Venezuela, are you invited, or do you go and say, we have some ideas, would you like them?
No, this all comes, it's a process. By now we have a reputation, I would say, that we're very proud of in Central and South America. I think we are considered the organization from the United States that comes down and is helpful. We partner with these people. These are our partners. And they're the lead partner because it's their country. And we bring to the party the kinds of things I talked about earlier. And we don't have to solicit them. They come seeking our partnership, and we invite that kind of thing. We bring them up to our various state programs and have their top guys train with our top guys and ladies. I'm sorry about that, Susan. I have three daughters. You'd hardly believe my insensitivity. The fact of the matter is that this whole business sort of hands across the sea. It works in the environmental movement. Our attitude is we don't care who gets the credit. We want the job done.
We've even been able to do some of that here in Alaska. We've worked, for instance, out on the Pribilof Islands, where they have a great deal to protect. In some circles, the Pribilofs are referred to as the Galapagos of the North. They have more bird species than any other single place in the Northern Hemisphere, and they have something like 98% of the entire fur seal population out there. At the same time, they have people who live there who need to make a living. And one of the things that they have been interested in is developing an ecotourism business out there, a business that will actually produce an income for the people on the island because of the resources that are there. And if the people on the island are making money because the seals are there and because the birds are there, they will be very invested in protecting those seals and those birds. We have taken people from the island to visit some of our preserves. We have a birding preserve within the Conservancy in Arizona. So some of the people from the corporation and the tribal council went down to look at how we manage that preserve. We make enough money off of visitors to Ramsey Canyon in Arizona to actually support the preserve, so the preserve doesn't end up costing the Conservancy money. And I think that kind of experience is the thing that the Conservancy can share, both with countries elsewhere in the world and with people here in Alaska.
We're talking today with Susan Ruddy of the Alaska Nature Conservancy and Dick Weinstein of the Nature Conservancy National. Susan, Alaska is thought of, almost held at the same time in different hands as massive, indestructible, too tough to die, and on the other hand, delicate and fragile. When you look at the state of Alaska as the director of the Alaska Nature Conservancy, where do you see it? Is it always fragile in your mind, or is it a huge, tough state that can tolerate whatever humanity takes to it?
Well, this is going to sound like the mediator. I think both are true. I don't think it can tolerate, the last thing you said, however, I think makes me come down on one side. I don't think it can tolerate whatever humanity brings to it. No. Any of us who've lived here for any length of time have seen tremendous changes on the landscape. And I think there are parts of Alaska that are, in fact, very fragile. There are other parts which can stand a great deal more activity of almost any kind. And I think it's up to those of us who live here to protect those fragile parts and to develop the other parts in a responsible manner.
When you think of most fragile parts, what comes to mind?
You know, I would love to answer that. Our data system, unfortunately, is still so young that we don't really have the adequate information for me to be able to answer that properly. But there are some of the river valleys, some of the wetlands, and I don't mean all of the wetlands, some of them, I'm sure would surface in that system, some of the coastal areas. You look at the mountain tops are probably less fragile. The ancient forests are probably more fragile. The rivers, we are working right now on the Kenai River. The Kenai River is one that we in South Central Alaska are in. Sometimes I think we're in the process of just loving that river to death. It has a unique species of king salmon, the largest in the world. So many people come from all over the country, and we certainly spend a lot of time down there fishing. We have proceeded to really wreck some of the river banks simply by walking along the banks to fish them. That needn't have happened, and it is something that we can correct. So while it's a fragile system in some ways, it has taken a great deal of use and some considerable abuse, but it can be turned around. It's not something that's terminal.
The Nature Conservancy uses a combination of staff and volunteer in management. On something like the Kenai Project, is this something that people of the Kenai and South Central Alaska could become part of a volunteer effort to?
Absolutely. We have just started on the Kenai Project. We're in the process right now of doing some sort of very boring, dry work that not a lot of volunteers would want to be involved in, looking at land status, who owns which piece, and making sure that's on the map, and then overlaying that land status information with the biological information. We have talked with a lot of people in all the different communities on the Kenai over the last couple of years before we even start this work. And eventually, whatever we do would become a Kenai project. It won't be a conservancy project. What we do will be turned over to the people of the Kenai and become theirs, so they will be running whatever it is that comes out of our effort. You asked a question about volunteers, and I don't know whether this is really relevant to what you were asking, but we, in the South 48, we use many, many volunteers on our preserves. In Alaska, we are not establishing a preserve system. So it's quite a different opportunity or challenge for volunteers. Dick mentioned something earlier today about hundreds of volunteers working at the Blowing Rocks Beach.
Yes, absolutely.
Which you mentioned earlier in this conversation. In Alaska, we have people call and asking what they can do to, as a volunteer. We don't have preserves. So we don't have, at the moment, opportunities for volunteers on our preserves. As we develop our program and work with communities like those on the Kenai, and some up farther north and some out to the west and along the Prince William Sound and so forth, there will certainly be volunteer opportunities. They won't necessarily be on our preserves, but they'll be on lands that we think are also important.
The Alaska Nature Conservancy hasn't acquired, has not acquired any land. Do you intend to, or is it just young yet, early yet?
No, we don't intend to be in the acquisition business here. We have acquired a few parcels. We have, for instance, worked with the Fish and Game to help them sort of reorganize the management process in one of their refuges. They had, there is a game refuge, a fish and game refuge north of Anchorage, the Palmer Hay Flats, which is a very significant waterfowl preserve. And the hunters love that area. There are some private property holdings within the preserve which cause the management of that area to be a little bit difficult. We've talked with some of the private property owners, and some of them have been very interested in selling. They no longer have, some of them really haven't wanted to own that land since it subsided after the earthquake. But there wasn't anybody out there talking to them about what their options were. So we've worked with them and been able to acquire several parcels which now belong to Fish and Game and which are enabling them to make their management of that refuge more coherent. So we are in the acquisition business. We're not in the preserve business. We won't be putting together a system of preserves. Our intent here, with all the land that's already in public ownership, 88% of our land is in public ownership, and 11.7% belongs to the native corporations. What we're trying to do, rather than buy land and put it into a system of preserves, is to work with the landowners, whether they are private or public, to accomplish what, it, as it turns out, interestingly enough, are their conservation goals as well as ours in most cases.
Susan Ruddy from the Alaska Nature Conservancy. Yes, Dick.
I was just going to say that until we get volunteer programs that they can physically work on, there is a physical act that we'd be delighted if anybody would like to do, and that's to write a check in support of the Nature Conservancy's work here in Alaska, because I think that that's one way to demonstrate that you think we're useful here, and if you look at our work, I think you'll agree that it is useful.
You have a number of donation programs. I noticed an Adopt an Acre program for...
That's down in Latin America.
In Latin America. Yeah. Currently for rainforests and cloud forests.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So
yeah.
If I adopt an acre, I don't own my acre.
Oh,
but
no.
I sponsor my acre.
Well, no, you get. I have the number one certificate from the Darien area because I was down there when we signed the debt swap, and for my $100, I got a piece of paper that says it was a hectare, though it's almost 2.5 acres. That's what you get. Together with a very warm spot in your heart.
Indeed, and letters from your rainforest once a month. What we have moments left, actually, and I'm interested in what you see as the future of the Nature Conservancy. Are there great issues of our times in terms of the environment that to you are yet untouched and need action, or are you doing the right thing and you're going to continue?
Well, I have a very limited perspective. I'm not a great scientist or a great thinker. I think I do feel that the work of the Nature Conservancy is important as a model for what must be done elsewhere, which is the preservation of biodiversity. I think everybody agrees that that's one of the great environmental issues of our time and of our age. And so to the extent that we all get on board that train in whatever way we can, the way we live, however you do it, I think it's an important thing to preserve the creatures of the world. We need them. They need us.
Susan?
Well, you know that we work a lot with the Native corporations in Alaska, and I have come to think very much in their terms. They talk about the seventh generation perspective, by which they mean that we need to be looking seven generations down the line and making sure that what we turn over to those generations is still of value to them.
Thank you. My guests today, both from the Nature Conservancy, one from the National Office. Richard Weinstein is a resident of Florida. He was educated actually at the University of Florida, graduate of the University of Florida Law School in 1949. He has been an attorney since then, a member of the bar in Connecticut and Florida, was the chairman of a board of directors of the Fairfield County National Bank for 12 years, and has worked as a volunteer for the National and International Nature Conservancy Governing Councils. Just retired from the International Governing Council for the Nature Conservancy, and since 1970, with a very brief interruption, has been on the Conservancy's National Board of Governors. From the National Nature Conservancy, Dick Weinstein, thanks very much, Dick, for joining us. And Susan Ruddy from the Alaska chapter of the Nature Conservancy. People will call and ask, so tell me how to get in touch with the Alaska Nature Conservancy office.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
I knew you would.
Our phone number is 276-3133, and our address in Anchorage is 601 West 5th Avenue, Suite 550, and that's Anchorage 99501.
Thank you. And with that, people can learn about National as well.
You bet.
All right. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thanks to my guests, and I hope you join me again next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much. That was fun.
That was fun.